Found in the Struce.
Congratulations, you've made it.
This is David Reinstein. Maybe you can hear where I am. Any guesses? I don't know how you could possibly guess, but I'm on the roof of a place called Trever, which is a co-living space in the, I think it's the center of Mexico City, in the, I believe it's the Roma Norte neighborhood. And I'm on the roof of this space because I've been staying here for the last couple of weeks, or week and a half, and it's my last day of the Effective Altruism Fellowship. As you can hear, it's an interesting place. It's rather noisy. This is the roof. It's beautiful sunshine. There's cactus plants and other succulents around, bean bags, nice plates to sit. You can see a picture maybe. Sort of cook-in supplies. Then there's this intersection. I'll walk in now. You'll see it here. It's a bit quieter, where we have refrigerator humming. We've got toasters and nice fancy coffee setup. Then there's the other. Anyways, it's been a really comfortable place to stay. The only downside is it does get noisy. One side much more than the other. I ultimately slept well and enjoyed being here. And it's in a super hip neighborhood. Lots of these digital nomads taking advantage of Mexico's favorable tax and migration policy. There's all sorts of a mix of, I guess, gourmet, hipster culture, and traditional Mexican things like your roadside taco stands and fruit stands. And anyways, I just wanted to give you a sense of the sounds of this place. And I was thinking of making a podcast or putting together a podcast. My last day, as I said, to summarize or to give people who weren't able to make it here or who are interested a bit of a flavor of what this experience was like. I hope I can achieve that. I'm going to try to slack people in the group. I'm out of breath, by the way. That's either because I'm out of shape or because I still haven't gotten used to the altitude here. Probably the former. So we have a Slack group, and I'm going to try to ask if anyone wants to share a few moments of their experiences or insights they had here, or just sort of reenact cool conversations so maybe you can get a flavor of what it's like here. So there is a post about this fellowship on the EA forum, so that could give you some information. I think it connected. I missed the first part of it, so my experiences may not be representative. It was intended to try to catalyze the Latin American EA community and the Mexican EA community. It was run sort of adjacent or overlapping the EA Global, EAGX Mexico. They rented this space, Trever, which I think is rather affordable but still comfortable. Hey, Agu. And they also rented an office space, which was just like a two-minute walk. And lots of people came around, and I'll try to give you a picture of them later. And I think it's been a mix of working together, having casual conversations, and doing a little bit of sightseeing. As you might know, audio editing for podcasts takes a long time, so in the interest of having some material out, I'm just going to release this first episode focusing on the conversations I had with Agustin Covarrubias, which start out fairly general, talking about his work, talking about Chile and Latin America, doing a little sightseeing, and then we have some conversations with a taxi driver who we try to engage and introduce this idea of effective altruism to, and perhaps some of you might find the discussion at the end most interesting, where we go through and Agustin tries to define and describe the different parts of AI safety work, and I try to get him to disambiguate them from one another, also while talking a bit about his career. In future episodes or future segments of this, I'll get into some more free-flowing group discussions with other people and discussions about the Mexico program in general.
Yes, Agustin Covarrubias. They call me Agus here.
How are you doing?
Very well. A little bit tired. I had to take like an early call today in the morning, but I'm very excited. A little bit. In the last year, I've been most involved with like field building, AA safety, and like EA in general at my university.
University? I forgot.
Yeah, I study at UC Chile.
So there's been a big Chilean component here at the...
Yes, we call our university UC Chile mostly like to trick people's brains into thinking it's a branch of University of California. Well, it's actually the Catholic University of Chile, even though like most of us aren't Catholics.
Your parents won't listen to this, so don't worry.
Yeah, I'm not that worried about that.
Cool.
Before I came into AA, I was working also with like a bunch of NGOs and the like civil society space, and that's something I continue doing. More like now thinking mostly about.
Me lo han dicho que usted ha estudiado derecho.
Así es.
¿Has oído de la cosa, el tema que estábamos hablando, que se llama altruismo eficaz o en ninguna vez? ¿Conoce altruismo eficaz, la palabra, la frase?
No.
No.
At this point in the conversation, I made the big mistake of trying to use the imperfect subjunctive, which was something that was heavily emphasized in school, and I was trying to ask if you were to think of the phrase effective altruism, what would you think it meant? Anyways, this ended up confusing him and everyone. Here it goes.
¿Qué pensaba que fuera?
¿Turismo eficaz?
No, altruismo.
Agustín came in here to help
what
me.
What do you think it is?
¿Qué piensas que es?
Del nombre.
Ok, el altruismo eficaz que realmente quienes deciden ayudar a alguna comunidad o alguna sociedad o alguna persona sea realmente que reciba ese apoyo
actually,
o esa ayuda,
eso
sería
un
altruismo eficaz. ¿Por qué? Porque muchas veces
altruism.
El altruismo se hace pero no llega realmente a la finalidad, se queda en los procesos
But it doesn't get
se queda un poco en stand-by,
realized, gets stuck,
porque realmente yo creo que el mundo, no nomás México, sino el mundo,
world, Mexico,
le faltaría mucho de humanismo para poder ser personas de mucho altruismo y de todo, sobre todo, ser sensibles ante los problemas y ante la sociedad.
Creo que es una muy buena aproximación de lo que el concepto significa. La diferencia está haciendo que el altruismo eficaz pone particular énfasis en que cuando tu objetivo es ayudar a las personas o hacer bien, a veces importa más el problema que escoges que cómo intentas solucionarlo. Entonces, en la práctica, por ejemplo, una persona podría tener muy buenas intenciones y querer ayudar a su comunidad local, por ejemplo, a través de un voluntariado. Pero tal vez esa misma persona con su mismo tiempo podría hacer otra cosa.
But they could do something
si
else.
Es un abogado, en vez de hacer voluntariado, podría estar trabajando en políticas públicas, por darte un ejemplo.
Work on public
policy,
for example.
El altruismo eficaz enfatiza en que, como tomar esa decisión seriamente, como en qué vas a gastar tu tiempo, es muy importante a
really
como
important
cuánto tiempo puedes terminar haciendo.
How you
do si realmente, perdón que te interrumpa, que realmente, si tienes alguna profesión o oficio, lo
so
puedas
have
dedicar.
A profession,
o sea, que desde tu punto de vista profesional o de oficio lo puedas ayudar.
Eso es parte, sí, pero también es como de todas las cosas que podría estar haciendo que hace un bien, ¿cómo yo escojo la que efectivamente como mejor me pone me pone la mejor posición para ayudar a otras personas?
Entonces,
por ejemplo, por darte una solución un poco rara. Hace poco, la comunidad altruismo eficaz, como son muchas fundaciones, ONGs, etc. Y hace poco se propuso, por ejemplo, que tal vez una causa como extrema, como que podría tener muchísimo impacto, podría ser trabajar en ciertas políticas públicas en países en vías de desarrollo para prohibir ciertos pesticidas. ¿Por qué podría ser tan importante? Resulta que hay ciertos pesticidas que no están prohibidos en la mayoría de los países en vías de desarrollo, que causan un declive como en la inteligencia de poblaciones completas, como tremendamente dañino, como evita el desarrollo de niños, como súper, súper malo. Y si tú pudieras convencer a un gobierno de pasar una ley al respecto, podrías ayudar a millones de personas como entonces. Y resulta que como que más encima ese es justamente como el tipo de ley que curiosamente no es tan difícil pasar, porque la industria pesticida no tiene tantos incentivos por mantener esos pesticidas en particular. Resulta que hay pesticidas que cuestan más o menos lo mismo, que son más seguros. Entonces, un altruista eficaz podría decir de que tal vez para un abogado promedio que quiera hacer bien o tener impacto social, tiene más sentido dedicarse a un proyecto como ese que un proyecto obvio, como por ejemplo en tu comunidad local o incluso en tu mismo país.
Wow, es interesante porque realmente muchos no lo vemos así, sino nada más buscamos el bien común, bueno, el bien propio, no el común.
Taxi driver's like, wow, no one thinks like that. Most people think of themselves or their local.
Que incluso cuando buscamos el bien común, no necesariamente gastamos mucho tiempo pensando en cómo precisamente cómo podemos alcanzar ese bien de forma efectiva. Como de ahí nace un poco la idea de como hay mucha gente muy inteligente y como con muy buenas intenciones trabajando en todos estos proyectos para intentar mejorar el mundo, ayudar a otras personas, etc. Pero lamentablemente solo una porción de esos proyectos terminan siendo como realmente importantes o como ayudan a muchas personas en la práctica. Entonces, hace como en 2014 como varias fundaciones se empezaron a juntar porque estaban como teniendo las mismas ideas, como este mismo cuestionamiento, y empezaron a hacer lo que se llama priorización global, que es como de todos los problemas que tiene el mundo, cómo yo escojo aquellos problemas que tal vez como hay mayores oportunidades para que una persona pueda tener impacto.
¿Y ustedes qué problema creen que sea el que acontece ahorita al mundo, uno de los más importantes?
Pero primero, ¿qué es lo que cree usted o pensaba usted sobre esto?
Pues que realmente lo que dice es cierto. Muchas veces como profesionistas no lo llegamos a ver. No tenemos esa visualización.
Y para ti, como por nombrar algo, ¿cuál crees que son los como para ti cuáles son los problemas más importantes o más como no sé cómo decirlo, urgentes en el mundo ahora?
Bueno, primero, o sea, para poder hablar del mundo, yo te podría decir primero me enfocaría en mi país, que ¿ya? Es uno de los problemas más importantes que tiene ahorita el país en materia es la seguridad. No es que necesitemos más policías, no, realmente no. No necesitamos ni más policías, ni 20 cámaras, no. Porque lo único que haces es cuidar al pueblo por un momento. Realmente aquí la conciencia es lo que debe de cambiar. ¿En qué sentido? Desde la educación. Yo, o sea, si usted me dijera ahorita, hoy tienes la oportunidad de cambiar en materia de seguridad tu país, ¿qué harías? Invertiría en educación y en trabajos, porque una vez que inviertes en eso, empiezas a quitar tasas de inseguridad. ¿Por qué? Porque lo que más acontece en México, los problemas delictivos, es el robo y el secuestro. Entonces, realmente yo invertiré eso para poder atacar la materia de seguridad. Y en el mundo, híjole, creo que son innumerables los problemas, pero uno sí sería el calentamiento global y todo lo que son las industrias, todo lo que toman de recursos, no porque necesitemos un pago, pero ese pago debería de ayudar a poder seguir manteniendo esos recursos naturales que son no renovables, que el día que se acaben realmente se acabó el mundo. Entonces, eso es uno. Dos, en materia de salud, hay mucha gente que necesita trabajo, doctores, investigadores, que podríamos tener una salud impecable en el mundo, pero realmente también existe aquí un tema muy, muy fuerte que es la corrupción. Entonces, yo creo que esos dos temas serán lo más importante ahorita en el mundo.
Muy interesante. De hecho, estoy muy de acuerdo contigo en, por ejemplo, el cambio climático. Como algo interesante del altruismo eficaz que cambia un poco la perspectiva con respecto a los problemas globales, porque una pregunta es cuáles son los problemas como más importantes o más grandes en escala, ¿cierto? Como cuáles afectan a más personas como de forma más intensa. Pero hay otra pregunta que puede hacer que es como en promedio, si tengo que escoger un problema, ¿cuál es el problema donde yo puedo tener más impacto? O más específicamente, más impacto marginal, ¿cierto? Como el impacto que yo consigo de como ser la siguiente persona trabajando en este problema en particular. Entonces, en el caso del cambio climático, por ejemplo, un análisis común es como el cambio climático es un problema muy grande en escala y importancia, pero hay otros dos factores que debes considerar a la hora de trabajar en un problema. Uno es lo que se llama la tractabilidad, o qué tan fácil es resolver el problema. Y el otro es lo que en inglés se llama neglectedness, que es qué tan descuidado está el problema. Okay. Entonces, en el caso del cambio climático, por ejemplo, un análisis posible que puedes hacer es como, ok, el problema es gigantesco en escala y afecta a muchísimas personas, por lo tanto afecta a millones y millones de personas en el futuro, pero no queda tan claro como cuál es la forma más fácil de resolverlo. Es un problema difícil y hay muchas personas trabajando en el problema. Como incluso si es que, no sé, tenemos industrias y muchas personas en contra, como evitando que haya progreso en el tema, si hay fácilmente miles y miles de personas alrededor del mundo intentando resolverlo, y hay mucha plata también puesta, o mucho dinero, en intentar resolverlo. Entonces, uno de los como principios del altruismo eficaz es esta idea de como, a la hora de pensar qué problemas trabajar, preocuparse no solamente de qué tan importante es, sino como por ejemplo qué tan descuidado está el problema y qué tan fácil es resolverlo, y eso ayuda un poco como a reorientarte como por ejemplo profesional, porque significa como tal vez hay un problema que es mucho menos importante, tal vez no es tan grande como el cambio climático, pero resulta que yo como profesional estoy en una posición muy buena de poder resolver ese problema en particular, o quizás es un problema que ni siquiera sabemos qué tan difícil resolverlo, pero no hay nadie trabajando en el tema. Es como soy la primera persona trabajando en este problema. Entonces en ese caso...
está abandonado, o bueno, claro. O no tienen conocimiento de causa.
Entonces... Por ejemplo, antes de la pandemia, antes de COVID-19, una causa popular entre altruistas eficaces era prevención de pandemias. ¿Por qué? Porque parecía que había mucha evidencia científica diciendo como es muy probable que esto ocurra, pero por alguna razón no había casi nada de plata o dinero invertido por gobiernos para intentar prevenirlo. Entonces, muchos altruistas eficaces empezaron a trabajar en el área de prevención de pandemias como en 2015, 2016, pensando como en esa idea de quizás no pase, pero hay tan pocas personas trabajando en esto que lo más probable es que lo vale. Claro, que lo más probable es que lo vale. Entonces, como ser solo, como si tenía un campo que tiene miles y miles de personas como el cambio climático, ser la siguiente persona trabajando en el área tal vez no hace tanta diferencia. Pero si hay como 10 personas en el mundo trabajando en prevención de pandemia, ser la 11ª persona es tremendo. Sí. Y eso fue más o menos lo que pasó en esos tiempos. Cuando llegó el COVID-19, de hecho, muchos como altruistas eficaces empezaron a trabajar rápidamente, es como que habían trabajado en vacunas, estrategias, cómo aconsejar al gobierno. Y en algunos países, de hecho, ayudaron bastante como a adelantar esas líneas de tiempo, como para alcanzar la vacuna, etc. Entonces, esa es como una idea interesante que como que aparece mucho cuando uno habla de estos temas, que es como cómo uno piensa en términos estratégicos, como si yo quiero tener una diferencia en el mundo, cómo yo definitivamente encuentro algo que no solo es importante, sino que también es como yo puedo tener un efecto como significativo en esto.
Sí, es real. Realmente, o sea, así tal cual lo estabas ahorita explicando. Pues sí, o sea, muchas veces vemos un problema y el problema lo conoce medio mundo, pero trabaja nadie en él y en otro lo trabajan todos y no hay un avance.
Claro.
When you visit Mexico, you do see a lot of sites having to do with the pre-Hispanic culture and then the Spanish imposition of their own culture and building right on top of the previous power of Tenochtitlan. They built Mexico City on top of it, and it raised a lot of questions in my mind and considering how do people think about that today.
You'd say, and I guess I should have talked to some of the other Chileans about this, so you'd say like there's some schools where they talk Columbus as a hero and other schools where it's a more nuanced view.
I would say most schools in Chile taught a very nuanced view of like colonization as a process, how it changed, how it both have like very negative effects on local indigenous people in the case of Chile. There's like a very rich history of that. But also like the counterpart of like how colonization fits into the history of like Chile, by example.
And do most Chileans identify more with the Spaniards or more with the native population, or even or other than that, like maybe like other immigrants?
I would say they don't identify with either. I don't know, like to a point. In Chile, integration eventually was relatively successful to some degree.
Yeah.
Which meant that national identity is actually a mix.
Of course.
Most people can also, like, I think, like, Chilean tends to, like, be placed as a very independent identity that combines different legacies.
Right. Like, a little bit like what we say in the United States. But, no, I'm just asking because when I talked to Richard from Peru, he said that the Spaniards were very much taught to be seen as the villains in this story at this point. And I think it might be the same in Mexico.
I think there's a tendency. Point,
and he thought it was over too much in that direction, potentially. But
I think there's a tendency towards that. But I do think, like, Mexico, by example, might be a more salient example of it. Of that like, general tendency to view history, specifically colonization processes, being...
But do you think they have possibly a more closer feeling of connection to
right, them? Right, obviously.
That's good. But what is the EU
project? It was started by several EAs a couple of years ago, which attempts to legislate on aspects of precisely. It tries to define a concept of safe AI.
Yeah.
And from that, it tries to create a regulatory structure where companies developing AI systems might be forced to test their systems for robustness. Or safety, yeah. Or diversity, yeah. Or
I think
other
it's kind of cool that the EU is a big enough market that, like, if you don't want to lock yourself out of the EU, you have to do these things.
Yeah, but actually, that's one of the, like, the bigger benefits. Like, if you did it in the US, you don't necessarily have, like, such a big...
No one would want to lock themselves out of the US market either.
Actually, yeah.
But what about... but what I don't understand is, like, what's the connection between the work you're doing now, even as career capital... for AI governance? Is it because you're working with governments?
No, I don't think it's, I think for ConcealInvest specifically, the career capital I'm mostly getting is, on one side, software engineering, which I don't really need that much.
Well, for AI governance, I guess that wouldn't be a factor.
It wouldn't at all. And the other hand is research, which is a much more general skill. I don't know, like, I think it's still preliminary. I don't think it's the best job in terms of career capital in that sense. I think for me, going into a full-on research role seems like it makes more sense in the medium term.
But, because the work you'd be doing if you were going to pursue the AI safety and governance role would be research?
Yeah, mostly... Okay. Research regarding legislative proposals, policy briefs, policy analysis.
Okay, so it would be, like policy research, that sort of thing. So then you'd need to have background, in law or in how governments work?
What I did was ask Hayden Balefield precisely Hayden is pretty much one of the leading experts in AI policy in the world. He came to AGX LATAM. Basically, he told me, you could take, by example, like a master's in policy or international relations, which might be relevant, but also beyond like general research skills, beyond general like analytical and writing skills, it's more likely the case that it's the kind of things you learn as you do it, right?
Okay.
You get familiarized with, by example, how a specific power axis in international relations influence the development of AI, for example, the competition between China and the US.
Yeah. But... it seems like something where there's a lot of sort of qualitative exploration to be done rather than, you know what I mean? Like, because we're talking about something where we don't have a lot of data and it's like, it's a future potential competition, right?
I think it's also the case that also happens with technical AI safety research. Yeah. It's very, like, it's I think the entire field is in a pre-paradigmatic stage. Very slowly crawling towards maybe a sort of paradigmatic stage.
If that's good, I don't know. But let me just take a step back and ask you, why is it you think that this would be your fort? Why would this be your strength?
Okay.
Or why would this be, right?
What I, like, in parallel of when I entered, like, to study CS engineering at my school, yeah. At the same time I started working alongside the Chilean Senate in a particular project. It wasn't very big or anything. It was called Youth Prospective Committee. It was basically, the idea was to have, like, a bunch of people, very young people, to advise on policy matters. From that, I started, like, getting into the policy world in Chile, and I also took, like, a couple of elective classes on international relations and strategy and safety studies, also public policy as well. And I started, like, getting into that world. And quickly I learned that, A, I think it's something I can, at least I can think I can get very good at very quickly, even though I don't have a policy background, by example. Or
you can get good at it, but can you get, like,
an advantage, a competitive advantage? Yeah, the point Hayden made, that is actually the biggest question I had.
Like, in other words, is it just sort of a leveling up and then everyone's at a pretty similar level and everything else is maybe, like, you have good personality traits?
Okay, so I think there are two things here. One is, if I go to the technical AI safety side, I'm mostly the average profile there.
You think so?
Sure, okay. There are some technical AI safety researchers who are not that good at research engineering, and in that aspect, it's something good that I could have.
What do you mean by research engineering?
Basically, if you have, by example, the theoretical basis for an experiment, actually being able to go and run it, analyze the results, and everything. That is not something necessarily all technical researchers have, even though it has technical in the word, because most technical work, at least now, is very theoretical, and it doesn't necessarily compare with.
I think of course I'm coming from a particular point of view, but my impression is that's an area that we have a strong lack of skills and people willing to devote time and energy to.
I think it's kind of weird because in the traditional, this is also really good. In the traditional ML side, like machine learning, this very experiment-based workflow is extremely common, right? Like, to be an ML expert is to be a very good research engineer, to a degree.
So when you talk about the ML research, so you're talking about, because, you know, for someone who hasn't done it, you're talking about, setting up environments to run tests of what ML can achieve or how it behaves in certain...
Yeah, by example, it's
Or I should say AI, right?
Having an idea for how a new architecture could improve the performance in a certain task and implementing an experiment that actually tests that out.
Is that safety? How is that safety?
No, that is just ML. So what I think it's different about AI safety is that because it's based on theoretical assumptions of future AI models or agents, it basically means that they're only, like, experiments are meant to be mostly illustrative of a bigger concepts, and it's not always clear how to tie the theoretical background work that is being done with, like, actual experiments we can run.
What worries me, that's, like, a bit of an overstatement, but what I think I dislike in research is when people are like, here's the theory that I'm trying to show, right? So it's like, I don't have any uncertainty over what the truth is. It's just like, I think I have this theory that I'm trying to, I hear this from experimental economics in the lab. People are like, we're trying to demonstrate in the lab this. And I'm like, well, why are you trying to demonstrate something if you already know the answer? I worry that they're kind of like just coming up with something that generates the result they want.
Right. I think in some ways, the first experiments that are being made in the field of AI safety kind of are exactly like that. But it's good because kind of the point is we have this theoretical thing we think it might be possible, but we don't have empirical evidence that it could happen. And that if we can actually craft examples of this happening on an ML algorithm with under reasonable assumptions, then it seems like that at least strengthens the case.
In other words, what is the value of the information there? Or put it this way, do we learn when it doesn't do what you thought it was going to be able to do? Is that also reported and made part of the record?
Definitely. By example, one very speculative conclusion of early AI safety research was that it's very likely for some models or agents to learn to be deceptive to people. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it lets them either get higher reward objectives in the long term, or it's useful for getting to their instrumental objectives otherwise. So this is theoretical. It's basically we think this might happen for sufficiently advanced AI, but this feels very preliminary yet. So what happened was DeepMind, the AI safety team at DeepMind, found this kind of elaborate example with something like deception happened. Particularly what happened is they were training this robot arm to grab a ball. Hmm. And basically humans had to give feedback to the model, which would build a reward function. And what happened is the robot actually learned to hold the ball, or like actually hold its hand in front of the camera in such an angle that it would appear for humans that it was actually grabbing the ball when it wasn't. That's not a strictly deception, but it feels like that's indicative that the principles that underlie the earlier theoretical work might be true.
Yeah, but what I was asking for was like an example where you, in order to learn something, it has to be that sometimes it comes out one way and sometimes the other, so that I have real updating. There has to be real uncertainty at the beginning, and I think the scientific record has to show both directions of outcome. Right, so what's an example where the hypothesis was like AI can do this and then they found that it couldn't do this?
You're basically asking if it can be falsified.
Yeah. Or if the falsification enters into the scientific record ever. Or just people sort of say, oh, well.
I don't think so. I think there sure are examples where you can track this very elaborate model trying it to be deceptive or something else, and it simply doesn't happen. But in practice,
you don't report on that.
But in practice, even if you reported on that, I don't think it would put any weight against the hypothesis, because sadly, we're not on a stage where most models are advanced enough where you could actually test the hypothesis being made. It's sad because
we should have like some sort of, for the research to be useful, it should be like we have a belief that some things, some capacities are possible and others are not, or some capacities are possible in the X term, some term length, and other capacities may not be possible, and then the research should allow us to differentiate between those two, right? If it's not clear how I'm updating my beliefs. Or do you understand the question?
I would say
issue.
At most, the field is at a stage where you can have proof of concepts of certain things, but it's not yet on a stage where it's very likely or helpful to try to find examples of behavior not happening. Why? Because that is the default, right? At the current state of AI research, we don't have very sophisticated models seeking for instrumental goals. The hypothesis is that future models would have it.
I still think there has to be something that we update on, and it has to. You can't always have the same. The beliefs have to pay rent, right? As what is it, Minkowski said.
Yes.
It can't always be the same thing that you're reporting. So there, I think there has to be some information value from people doing extensive trials and not finding the behavior, emerging that they hoped that they were, testing whether it would emerge or not. That has to have some information value. Therefore, it should be reported in the record.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. In the sense that if, by example, an AI safety research goes and tries to advocate a certain behavior and it doesn't really happen, then it makes sense to report a negative. I'll just say that I don't think that negative might be particularly helpful, except because it's informative on, like, it might be very informative in terms of like in what conditions it might not happen, but it's not really useful if you think your blogger is degree of advanced model or like whatever, it's the complexity of your model.
It has to be informed. You have to have information in both direct. It has to be informative in both directions. Therefore, otherwise, it's not informative in either direction.
What I'm saying is, it's in a hypothesis where it's very difficult to find either confirming or disconfirming evidence at this point. It's mostly speculation at this point because we don't have any alternative.
Right, but for, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but for me to update my, when I see a behavior emerging, for me to my update my beliefs in one direction, it must be that when I don't see that behavior emerging, I need to update my beliefs in the other direction.
Sure, but this, that the opposite update might be extremely small. Because, like, fundamentally, the claims being made are about the possibility of something happening given very, like, very complex situations we don't understand yet. So, obviously, observing it would be a great confirmation because...
Well, let me say then that for that to be a very big... For that to be true, it should have to be that most studies would actually find, you know, the
which
lack
is the
of
case,
behavior.
Right?
Okay.
It is the case
it
because
be like to know
right
how many
now
of those
we
were.
Don't see... We there aren't... I think the most ML research currently doesn't find the kind of behaviors that AI safety pays attention to, which is why actually when we try to compile examples, we usually compile the positive ones because it feels a little bit weird to signal to everything that hasn't failed yet.
I mean, I guess the other aspect of it is that it might be, in a sense, exploratory in that, like, you're not necessarily testing an up-down. It might be like, when the behavior does emerge, you want to know what form it takes. Is that possible? Like, because you can learn from that. Or you don't think you learn from that. Like the case you gave me with the machine shape moving its arm so that it looks like a ball in hand. Like, was that in the fact that it fooled you is one thing, but the other thing is, does the nature of the way it fools you inform you at all?
I will argue that the central claim or the central form most claims in the AI safety will take is behavior X is plausible given unknown conditions, or mostly unknown conditions. So when you have a claim like that, which is a claim about plausibility, then in general, it's very difficult to find like negative examples, very confirming in terms of your priors, even though it's obviously evidence,
well,
right?
But there's also this general problem of inductive reasoning, people say, right? Like, it's impossible. You can't prove that something doesn't exist or can't ever exist. If you don't define the space that you're exploring and can say that I've explored this space either probabilistically or completely, then I can never conclude a negative.
That is a crucial problem. But because it's so important for it to be implausible, then you're kind of stuck with it. It's a hard scientific problem because it has this very very bad properties, but also it's kind of what you got.
I mean, maybe there could be work and maybe there is work on like which things emerge more commonly or in ways that are harder to detect
that's,
or control.
That's definitely something that's happening. Where
so
like,
it could be like a relative prioritization of the different problems.
No, that's happening because especially in the case of like the premises of certain arguments for certain like misbehaviors, where you're like trying to establish a baseline or like a base rate to start thinking about at least define your priors in a relatively sane way.
I was speaking yesterday with, I'm sure you've spoken, no, actually, I don't know if you have spoken enough with Anna. You know Anna?
Yeah.
So she's working for Open AI. So I don't know if that's the bad side or the good side, but.
Wait, Anna, the one working on the effect AIs have on people?
Yeah, it was some sort of social experiment.
Wait, are you telling me she works at OpenAI?
She works at OpenAI.
Are you kidding me?
Wait, OpenAI is the one with the chatbot, right?
Yes.
So you think of them as the bad guys? I don't know, like, what... where to place them.
Kinda, yes. But also, I think there are very good people working there. Well, they have an entire safety team, and I very much value their work. I just don't think the priorities of the overall organization reflect that good work.
I mean, I've heard... I can never remember which organizations that we like or don't like. So OpenAI, that's a Google's thing?
No. That's Sam Altman. Founded by Elon Musk.
Elon Musk.
Currently, the CEO is Sam Altman.
Okay. Yeah, so no, they were, but she was doing research. She's trying to propose a research program having to do, but it's different than yours because it's not testing. It's not, I guess what you were just talking about now is technical AI research, right? Now, she was talking about research into how using these tools change people's personalities, maybe their behaviors, their attitudes, maybe that's similar
to personality. Yeah, I would point out that that type of research seems a little bit different from the general field of AI safety.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
That's more like the fairness, accountability, and what do you call it, transparency side, fact
I'm
world?
I'm not sure, like the fairness, accountability thing, what is that about? Is that about bias against minority groups, or what is
that's
that?
That's the iconic example of that world. Yeah. Obviously, like research into the human, it doesn't fit quite nicely into the acronym, but I think there's generally this... In the world of AI ethics, there's this camp that is researching, by example, the effects, consequences, and possible damages being caused by present models.
Yeah.
And then you have this much more speculative theoretical work being done on what damage future models might have.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the theory of change, well, she was also trying to motivate it as being relevant to existential risk, which it didn't, you know, first, to me, doesn't seem like a necessary thing to make it useful, but I can understand why some people might think that you know, that if it's not related to existential risk, it's not, shouldn't be a focus. But I think she was suggesting that that we need
Do you want a glass of water?
No, it's un vaso, un vidrio para mí también. Y otro, you don't know say vidrio?
That's a glass.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Literally a glass. Like a piece of glass.
Oh, okay.
You say vaso.
Vaso. Y un café, por favor, también. Americano, pero fuerte, con un poco de crema. Al lado.
Okay.
Al lado, gracias. So it was a literal translation. Sorry about that.
That was really funny.
Copa, vaso, any of those terms okay?
Yes, copa y vaso is okay.
Right, so... I guess the case was that, I mean, honestly, I'm trying to label, you know, translate it, but it was something like people will be working with these tools and need to monitor them, and then I said, oh, so you're worried that the AI is going to be tricking people and manipulating their personalities into doing things, and she was sort of saying, like, no, that's not the principal thing I'm focused on, I'm just focused on how it changes people's personalities, but, and if people like to work with it more or less, in ways that are helpful to them. But to me, it didn't seem clear how that would connect with the risk of AGI or AI.
Based on my conversation with her, I think the research she's doing is really important, but I don't think it really fits into the whole AI safety thing.
Okay.
In terms of the AI safety being very oriented on like existential risks.
Yeah. But I mean, like, that said, I think like probably if you think that one of the vectors for artificial intelligence being risky is being able to control people, you know, I suppose it does help to know how it's manipulating people or changing people's personalities, but you know, if she's doing testing the models on GPT-3, it's not going to be trying to manipulate people. It doesn't have any sort of...
Yeah.
I can't see how that
would
happen.
For what I got from what she told me is basically that she's really focused on more like the human aspect of it, humans, by example, create emotional relationships with the AI and so on, but not really thinking about like specifically like misbehavior from the AI.
I think that's right. Anyways, getting back to your thing, so like, but you're saying you want to go into AI, no, something about governance, but not research into AI governance or research into policy that would be relevant to AI safety, or somewhere in that.
Yeah, there's usually there's like this category of like four
four subfields of AI safety. Yeah. One is strategy, which is trying to think very hard about like the big questions about, for example, when transformative AI might come, what should we do about it, what types of research tend to have more success. Trying to prevent existential risks, for example. Then there's field building.
Wait, let me just understand. So this is within, is this within the overall line category of AI governance?
No, AI safety.
Okay, AI safety, okay.
So you have strategy, you have field building, which is basically community building. Then you have technical research, or more specifically, alignment, credibility, and control research. Mm. Or even interpretability as well, uh-huh. Which are like the four prongs of like full-on technical research. And then you have like policy and governance.
Alignment, interpretability. What was the other thing?
You have alignment. Then you have interpretability.
Yep.
And then corrigibility or control, which is basically about right being able to change behavior you don't want.
Which seems close to alignment to me, but okay.
Yeah, basically.
And then what's the fourth? You said four.
Oh, because I mixed control and corrigibility. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Is corrigibility another thing? A fourth one?
It's related to the control problem. But you could say that there are three approaches. One is working on alignment, which is basically how do we make sure the AI gets the right behavior immediately, right? At the first try. Mm-hmm. The second one is like corrigibility, which can you understand that?
I mean, it just feels like the alignment and corrigibility things would be connected, but what do I...
They are, but also there's some internal discussion about whether it's more promising to do one or the other.
Time. Okay, but then the other, this is interesting to map this out. So the other part of the field is, the first thing you said was...
Strategy,
and that I wasn't clear, again, how that differs from technical AI research. So, like, strategy, is the difference that with strategy, you're not, the research isn't going to actually involve actual AIs, you're just going to...
I would say strategy is trying to think about big picture questions regarding AI safety itself. By example, like people working on strategy will normally, work a lot with forecasting or estimating the effects of AI safety or by AI catastrophes, by example.
That's strategy.
So it's basically thinking very meta about what certain things to pursue or what is the current best knowledge we have about the priority of
that's going to depend a lot on the research coming out of AI safety,
no,
I guess.
No, definitely. Right? There's certainly an interaction, right? And also strategy informs the priorities that are used in the rest of the...
But I mean, right, so strategy, like, you don't just need to know what the biggest risks are.
You also need to know, obviously, yes.
What were you going to say? I'm just curious if it's the same thing that I was going to say.
Oh, it's not just about the risk. You also need to understand the technical case for how...
But you have to make the pass to say, okay, I was in my house, your house, and I was doing these things. And
so do you make to so you say, I was in my house, but like politely you say, your, which is your house as well.
Yeah, it's your house.
But you don't
well.
Just say your house because then it would be confusing, right? Because then you wouldn't say like if we were actually in your house... If I was actually in your I don't say your house, my house, do I?
Yeah. No. That's why it's confusing. But here, I don't know, in Spanish, it's, and here in Mexico City, it's quite clear. Because it's when you're referring to your, when I refer to your house,
two,
you, we say, oh, when we were in, when we were in Massachusetts in your house, no? And you start with a place. And then you say your house.
Okay.
It's always, it's quite easy to make the difference, no? I was in Tlalpan in my house, your house, of course. And we were making these things.
That's
no?
really nice.
That's
yeah?
so nice.
That's really nice.
And literally, if any time you come and you want to come to my house, please, I offer that to you. Really, indeed.
Yeah, and you're in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Cheers. Yeah, nice, cheers. Yeah, if you want to go to... To my house anytime to with some dinner you we can I don't know like having contact and I have no problem with that. Okay, you can come to see Tlalpan and the great thing that are there. My grandfather arrived. Well, my grand grandfather arrived to Tlalpan and they built part of the of this part of Mexico. So
wow.
It's that, like tradition. Well, I'm from the Bilchis from Tlalpan. Actually, I don't know.
Bilchis is your
Bilchis
surname?
It's my Bilchis. Yeah, Bilchis with UV.
Okay.
Vilchis.
UV. Ah, vale, ya, es que lo llamamos.
No, perdón, perdón. With V. En español es V. No, es V.
V dice. Ah, UV, ok.
No, double V. En español se dice UV, pero estoy como tan acostumbrado. I have in my head that all the time I'm saying in Spanish, Vilchis with UV. But in English, Vilchis con V en español. Pero in English, there is not such thing like UV. We say the V,
yeah.
It's UV, because it's like the U.
Para V.
For V.
I've totally lost.
Yeah. So we
found in the Struss. Congratulations, you've made it.